This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Later on, we present economist Dean Baker on the economic crisis and present plans to attack Social Security. But first...
More than 600 workers in Visteon car plants in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and Enfield and Basildon, England, were given six-minute notice before their factories would be closing, leaving them without jobs and without contractually agreed-upon layoff benefits. The workers staged spontaneous sit-ins.
The workers in Enfield stopped their occupation after being threatened with long jail sentences. They're now picketing the plant around the clock. The occupation continues in Belfast. We're joined by Phil Wilson, machine setter from Visteon in Enfield, and Jerry Campbell, retiree from the Visteon Belfast plant.
Why don't we begin with six-minute notice of a plant closing? Please give us some of the background of what happened.
This is Phil from Enfield. We turned up for work on the Tuesday, was directed to a meeting room where we was greeted by some administrators. We was given 6 minutes notice during this meeting. They said, the company's gone into administration. Any monies owed to you, you will need to claim off the government. You'll be receiving some forms through the post. Now you need to collect your personal belongings and leave the plant. As simple as that.
In Belfast, it was the same scenario, but there was workers here, as there is in Enfield, 31 over 40 years service, given 5 minutes notice to get out of the plant because Visteon was getting in the administration, as if this was a surprise to Visteon, when the documents are all out there, that this was a pre-planned action by Ford Motor Company and Visteon to close the Visteon UK operations. And in Belfast plant, they moved our products, which Ford still need today, to other Visteon locations where they'd be taking cheap labour, exploiting the workers in other countries. Now, we know American workers are suffering very badly at the moment, but Ford and Visteon didn't take these products back into Ford locations. They're going to exploit them now in cheap labour countries like South Africa, the Philippines, and China.
Absolutely right.
Phil, Jerry mentioned Ford. What's the relationship between Visteon and Ford?
The majority of us that are working in this plant, when we started our employment, we signed contracts with Ford Motor Company. When Visteon was spun off from Ford Motor Company, we was promised Ford terms and conditions for the lifetime of our employment. We feel that they've reneged on that agreement totally. So there's a very close link between the Ford Motor Company and Visteon. They're both just as responsible for the situation we're in.
And that's absolutely true. But in the year 2000, we actually weren't allowed to sign anything. We had to go into Visteon UK, but we were given the lifetime guarantee from Ford, or else there would never have been a Visteon. The documents that was signed by Jack Nasser, the chief executive officer of Ford Motor Company at the time, and 5 other of his executives, including Peter Pastillo, who became chairman of Visteon. Signature of the chief executive officer of Ford Motor Company isn't legally binding, then why is Alan Mulally not resigning right now? If his word's no good, why should anybody go into an agreement with Ford Motor Company, whether it's a trade union, the United Auto Workers, or any government? How can you trust these people if they do not respond to their own agreement?
Tell us about the kind of parts that were made in the Visteon factories, and more about who worked in them, how many workers, and how long, just to give a kind of human face to what was going on there, and what this means for people to lose these positions.
In Enfield, we made plastic parts for the interiors of cars, dashboards, etc. At the time that we were all effectively sacked on the 31st of March, there were around about 220 employees. We were left with nothing instantly. We've got to claim whatever we can claim off the government. That can take 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks, before we receive any monies at all. Instantly, you've got people, my colleagues, that can't put food on the table. They have no money. They have no savings. They can't pay their mortgages. People are in an unbelievable situation. It's absolutely devastating.
In Belfast, we made products which Ford Motor Company still need today. They need them, and they're taking them from Visteon again, but in cheap labour countries. What Phil has just said there about employees being devastated, I've got 3 of my colleagues here sitting with me. They don't know how they're paying their mortgages. Totally devastated. Their future's wrecked because of the way this has happened. Now, you introduced me as somebody who has just retired, which is true. Vistion, since the year 2000, could have up to 5,000 pensioners like me out there. And our pensions are all threatened as well by the way that they have done this, by trying to asset strip the company and throw us into administration so that they do not have to honour their pay, redundancy and retirement commitments, which Ford agreed to in the year 2000. And Vistion Corporation has promised to honour since the letters that we have since 2002.
Jerry, why don't you put one of your comrades on the line?
I can pass you over to Kevin Nolan, who's the union convener for this plant. I'm sure he'd like to speak to you.
And Belfast will put you on the brand burns.
Hello?
Gentlemen, I just want to go back again and get a sense. First of all, what are some of the things that were manufactured in the various car companies? And for who? I know one of them was Land Rover and Jaguar.
At Enfield, we produce instrument panels for Land Rover and Jaguar, and instrument panels for the transit van for Ford. Belfast, they produce fuel rails, primarily all for Ford. Basildon plant, they produced radiators and condensers for mainly Ford Motor Company and some Jaguar Land Rover.
And how long have you worked in the plant, and what kind of work did you do?
I've worked here for nearly 20 years. And the average here is around 20 years to 35, 40 years service for most employees. And I was originally a fork truck driver, and then I've become convener about 15 months ago.
And Brian?
Yes, the Belfast plant, we made products entirely for Ford. For the Ford Fiesta, it's a small car, and the Ford Focus. We have never made any parts for anybody but the Ford Motor Company. Personally, I've been here 20 years. I joined as an apprentice, and about 11 years ago, I became an area foreman. I'm also the foreman's rep. I'm 36 years of age. Redundancy is no good to me. This factory needs to be reopened. There is another 10 or 12 people like me, maximum service for their age. These guys have 3 kids under 9, you know. How we're going to pay our mortgages, how we're going to pay our bills, it's just been so cruel what the company have done. We need the jobs.
So it's not like there are no cars being made in the world anymore. So what is actually happening to your jobs? And what did you all do when you found out with 6 minutes notice that your plants were going to be closed?
When we got brought in and told by the administrators that our jobs were gone, it was an overwhelming state of shock set in, and most people couldn't believe it. So we were walking around the place in a complete state of shock. Some people started emptying their lockers, and I'd say about an hour and a half after we're told, we're still walking around the plant, totally dumbfounded. And then I'm not sure how it all kicked off, but a lot of people at the same time says, no, we're not going. And they took the decision then to occupy the plant, and we've been here ever since.
You're in the occupied plant right now, right?
Yep.
This is the Belfast plant. From day one, the employees who were sacked stated that they would not go home without a fight. Maybe that's the Belfast part of them. They're here. They're going to stay until Ford come to the table or send Vistion to the table, hopefully to try to get the jobs back. Because see the parts that we made 2 weeks ago? Ford still need them today. Only they're now getting them from South Africa. It's not as if the product closed. The product that we make is still needed. Our machines are here ready to run. We can supply Ford within 24 hours' notice. Another guy here, John McGuire, who's the plant convener.
Let's talk to the brother.
I just want to explain how Ford and Vistion manufactured the losses in Belfast. It was colluded between them. When Ford left, they gave us Ford mirror terms and conditions. We were never a strategic fit for the Vistion product range, so we were never going to be allowed to make parts for anybody other than Ford. Toyota once wanted us to quote for work, but Ford wouldn't let them. So here we had a situation where Ford guaranteed our terms and conditions for life, but would only pay Vistion, who we were making the work for, would only pay Vistion third world prices for the components we made for Ford. So there was like a circle here, which manufactured losses for Belfast, which, I mean, it was an impossible situation. It was set up between Ford and Vistion that it couldn't make money.
I want to talk more about the occupation itself. First, I want to talk about the situation in Enfield in London. Now, you gave up the occupation. You were under a lot of pressure. What happened during the occupation, and then what kind of pressure you were under to do what you did, which is now you're picketing outside 24 hours a day? Kevin?
What happened was that on the first day that were in the plant. Myself and the deputy convener were served papers to take us to court by KPMG. The original documents they served on us had the wrong address. Part of the building was demolished, so they're trying to evict us out of part of the plant that didn't no longer existed. After that, they served more papers a few days later for us to appear in the High Court in London, the Strand, where they tried to commit myself and Piers Hood to jail and a possession order to get the plant back. But the union's lawyers put the case together to stop them doing that. But we had to leave the plant peacefully on Thursday noon as part of the deal. Since then, we've been picketing the plant, 24-hour pickets on all the gates.
In the United States, here, auto workers are catching hell. There is blame that is placed on the workers as though their work, their benefits, their pension, their health care, their wage level is what is bringing about the non-profitability of the auto plants. And so the sentiment continues to be to squeeze the workers, to take back as much as can be. Is that the same kind of media PR that is put out in Belfast and in Basildon and in Ensfield about the auto workers? And if so, how does the public relate to that?
Jerry again from Belfast. Yes, that was the line that we have been fed for quite a while. And the workers in here actually agreed voluntarily to take like a 10-hour reduction every 2 weeks. They introduced new workers at a lower rate because of all this credit crisis, which has been going on for the past 12 months. But what we discovered was that Ford and Vistion were in what we would call a secret project called Protea or Cummings, where there was a deliberate plan going back to at least May 2007 to transfer our products out, close the business. So no matter what we would have done regarding our terms and conditions and our pension rates and stuff like that, it had been predetermined. What happened then was, let's find the excuse to close it and blame it on the workers. As you know, these documents do go back to at least 2007 when there was profit.
Let's go back to the Enfield plant also. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I totally agree what Jerry's just said, because what we've seen in Enfield over the last at least 4 or 5 years is that the company have transferred work out of the plant to the cheaper countries like the Czech Republic, where they can make more of a profit on it and reduce the jobs over here. And they've been doing it gradually over years. So we've gone from 800 jobs down to 240 jobs. The company didn't need to do this. They were getting to where they wanted to be anyway. And we believe that they've used this recession to get out the back door of paying our pensions and our pay, which is an absolute scandal as far as we're concerned. We're talking about two multinational companies that have just put 600 UK employees into poverty. If both Ford and Vistion had gone bankrupt, then maybe we could understand that. But they haven't gone bankrupt. They shouldn't be treating loyal employees who have done 20, 30, 40 years service in this manner is an absolute disgrace. And we feel we're not going to just go home to our kids that we cannot feed no more and the houses we're about to lose. We thought we're going to stay here. And the people need to know this. You know, we're loyal, hard-working workers have been treated with absolute, there's no words for it.
What you should know as well is that in the past 12 months, there was a Vistion. And then 12 months ago in England, they decided to have a Vistion UK, which is these three plants, and a Vistion Engineering Service, which has about 400 employees based in the south of England, which are all middle and upper management. They separated them off, put them into a separate pension scheme, and did not put them in the administration. So Vistion still have a presence here, and now all of a sudden, in early February, three directors set up a new company called Automotive Products. By keeping that other company, Vistion Engineering Services, with about 400 employees, they threw the 600 workers on the scrap heap, the 5,000 Vistion pensioners into limbo because we don't know if our pensions are going to be affected, but protected themselves. So how can Vistion set up two separate companies and then suddenly just put one of the wings in the administration? Because it was always pre-planned.
And
no matter what the three factories do, and I do understand the type of problems that are going on with the American auto industry, and sympathies are there too, but we went down that road trying to facilitate the company. It wouldn't have mattered.
Well,
the decision was made to close, throw them on a scrap heap, and see how they can get out of here without paying what they agreed to pay.
Well, the lesson is cross-border organizing. The workers here must support their brothers and sisters abroad. We really are in that same life raft, and we are being thrown overboard. We have to support the Vestion workers, in this case in Great Britain and in Northern Ireland and Belfast. And we also have some lessons to learn about their militants in protesting these horrific conditions and situations where, indeed, workers are thrown on the scrap heap as the companies, the bosses go abroad to look for yet larger numbers of people to exploit at cheaper wages. I guess Workers of the World Unite is exactly what this is all about.
Very true.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Absolutely. Okay.
Good luck in the negotiations. We've been speaking with Phil Wilson, Machine Setter, Vestion Enfield Plant, on the picket line outside Vestion, and Jerry Campbell, retiree, Vestion Plant Belfast, in the occupied plant.
And their brothers. Good luck, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moving on to the U.S., economist Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, had warned for years about the coming recession. Now that we're in the middle of the crisis, the geniuses that got us into the mess have been appointed to get us out of it. How smart is that? But we can think of few better to outline what went wrong and how to begin to set it right than Dean Baker, who now warns us that some in the Obama administration and Congress are planning attacks in this year's budget on the Social Security Trust Fund to pay for the bank bailouts. And now, Dean Baker.
First off, what I want to talk about is that this crisis was totally foreseeable, totally predictable. It's really important to understand that because the people running the show were either corrupt or incompetent, and I'll let them choose. The point, and I was talking about this back in 02, and it was easy to see, we had a huge housing bubble. How did you know there was a housing bubble? We had a 100-year-long history where house prices had just risen at the same rate as inflation. House prices beginning in the mid-90s began to outpace inflation. That's unusual. Happened to coincide with the stock bubble. Same thing that happened in Japan. Their stock bubble and housing bubble collapsed at the same time in 1990. When our stock bubble collapsed in 2000 and 2002, what happened was it actually fed the housing bubble. Two reasons. One was people took a look at stock. They said that wasn't safe. So they said housing, by contrast, you could always live in your home. That's safe. The other reason it fed the housing bubble was the stock crash actually led to a fairly bad recession. We had a very hard time getting out of it. We had very low interest rates. That's an environment that fosters bubbles. Okay, well, it was easy to recognize the bubble. I first began talking about it when house prices had risen by more than 30% after adjusting for inflation. They eventually rose by more than 70% at their peak in 2006. I blame people like Alan Greenspan, people who are economists, people who do this for a living. It should have been very easy to see. Housing is a big market. Housing is a huge, huge market. It's a $20 trillion market at its peak. That's real money. So it doesn't just jump up and down erratically. When you see a 70% increase in house prices after adjusting for inflation, you should have some explanation in fundamentals. There was no demand-side story. Supply-side story, were we somehow constrained to build houses? There's a simple story there. Look at how many houses we were building. We're building houses at near-record rates. Okay, so anyone, pick the economist of your choice, anyone who was paying any attention should have been able to see that there was a housing bubble. It was real simple. The media should have been reporting on it. Economists should have been talking about it. Alan Greenspan should have been fighting it. Larry Summers should have been fighting it because bubbles are really bad news. They're not funny. They're not funny. We have a lot of people who are unemployed. They're losing their jobs. They're losing their homes. They're losing their health care. Families are breaking up because these people were either too dumb or dishonest to deal with it. It was really simple. Really, really simple as it could be. And I have a reporter, I've argued about this, he starts talking about, oh, but what about collateralized debt obligations? We didn't know about the credit default swaps. Some of that does get complicated. You didn't have to know any of that. That fed the bubble. The fact that we had these clowns in Wall Street who didn't know what they were doing, or maybe they did, but they didn't mind wrecking their banks because they were making a fortune in the meantime, that fed the bubble and allowed it to keep growing. But the basic point, we had this huge surge in house prices. We had $8 trillion in housing bubble wealth, phantom wealth that disappeared, $110,000 for every homeowner in the country. That was easy to see. It was inexcusable that you had professional economists, the people managing the economy, that did not see it. But almost without exception, they did not see it, and they argued with those of us who did see it. So we should be very, very angry. The reason we're here is because a lot of people were either incompetent or dishonest or both. Okay, so let's just be really clear on that. Okay, now let's get to the banks. We have this plan to bail out the banks, and we're told we have no option. We have to give them $1 trillion. And this is real money. I mean, this is, it's one of the things, again, I beat up on the media for, because most people, you know, in our lives, $1 million, we're not going to see $1 million, most of us. That's a lot of money. Then you talk about $1 billion. That's 1,000 million. Then you talk about $1 trillion. That's 1,000,000,000,000. This is real money. This is a real money. One way to think of it, we just had this big battle over the S-CHIPS, the State Children Health Insurance Program, that got extended. It was a good thing, but it was a big battle. You know, where are we going to get the money? You know, it was a real problem. Everyone's scratching their head. You know, we'd like to extend it, but where are we going to get the money? Okay, $1 trillion is 300 million kid years of S-CHIP. This is real money. Okay, so they're telling us we have to give this to the banks. Now, you have people like myself and Paul Krugman, who's now on our side, and Joe Stiglitz, a lot of other very good economists. They're saying, no, maybe we don't have to do this. Maybe we don't have to give that much money to the banks. You have the other people who are supposed to be the great experts, the ones who couldn't see the housing bubble, by the way, who are saying we have no choice. We have to give them the money. Now, let me just point out what I'm suggesting. And Krugman, and I'll speak for them, they're not here, but they've written similar things. What we're suggesting is that you could put them through a process of bankruptcy. This isn't nationalization. Maybe we want to nationalize them, but we're just talking about bankruptcy. This is capitalism, not socialism. They're bankrupt. You put them through a process of an ordered bankruptcy. We're being told that that's a crazy thing to think. You can't possibly do that. Well, let me tell you who thought it was a reasonable thing to think. Henry Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Timothy Geithner. They thought that you could have an uncontrolled bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers just 6 months ago. Now, that turned out to be a mistake. But you had those three people thought that you could have an uncontrolled bankruptcy. We're talking about controlled bankruptcy, an ordered bankruptcy. We have many more safeguards in place, and they're saying that's ridiculous. Well, maybe it is, but those three supposedly very smart people who are in the thick of things thought something more radical was reasonable 6 months ago. And before you go out and throw $1 trillion down the toilet, I think it's a reasonable question to ask. Are there alternatives? And I'm very unhappy about the idea we're just going to be giving this much money to the banks. Let me just say one other thing in that score before I get on to Social Security. The AIG bonuses, we were treated to this idea that, you know, let's not govern out of anger. We shouldn't get upset. Larry Summers, President Obama's chief economic advisor, talked about the sanctity of contracts. People should be incredibly upset. That money is our money. And the fact is, when a company is bankrupt, contracts are broken. Maybe Larry Summers doesn't know that. But he should, because he insisted that General Motors and Chrysler break their contracts with the auto workers. And let me be very specific. You have auto workers that worked 30 years for retiree health insurance. Now, maybe that was too generous. Maybe it was too generous. You know, these aren't bankers who get $1 million a year, $10 million a year. These are auto workers. Where do they get off getting retiree health insurance? Maybe that was too generous. But the point was, they worked for it. That was a contract. And Larry Summers said, you have to break that contract. Okay, because we're giving you money, and if you want to get the money, you have to break the contract. Well, we could do that. The government could do that, but we could do that with AIG, too. So why are those contracts sacred, but the auto workers' contracts get torn up? I don't quite understand that, and I don't really like it. Okay, the last point, Social Security. Yes, we won that battle in 2005. We shouldn't be talking about it. Actually, we should be talking about it. We should be talking about increasing it. And again, I mean, if we were in a sane world, just think, I mean, this is nothing radical. This is arithmetic. The people who, retirees, near retirees, you know, baby boomers, I got a way to go yet till I'm retired, but the baby boom cohort, the oldest baby boomers are in their 60s now. A lot of them are already retired. Many more are about to retire. They just got killed. They, insofar as they had money in 401ks, very few people have traditional pensions. I mean, traditional pensions are great, but the fact is those are dying. So most people in the workforce today don't have traditional pensions. So insofar as they had money in 401ks, well, guess what? They just lost half the value. Then on top of that, in their homes, you have an awful lot of people in their 50s who have zero equity in their homes, because I listen to these geniuses that house prices never fall. So you have this whole massive generation cohort of baby boomers that are on the edge of retirement, some already retired, and they've just seen all their wealth. These are people, I mean, I'm not saying it's good people are poor, but you have people who are poor their whole lives, it's not a surprise that they're poor. These people, they had accumulated something. They're also poor now. And now what you have are all these people in Washington who want to take away their Social Security. This is really just incredible. And it may well go through. I'm saying this is, these people thrive. They're like rats in the night because they won't do this in the broad of daylight. They want to have these special commissions. And there's a proposal. Let me just, has anyone heard about the reconciliation proposal? Can I see a hand? Anyone heard about the reconciliation proposal to have a commission on Social Security? No one's heard about this. This is the way these rats work. No, I'm serious. This is really incredible. We have a Congress. We have a democracy. They won't do this in public. They want to do it in the dark of night. They want to have a reconciliation proposal be attached to the budget bill. So you have this huge bill. This will be attached to it. They'll create a commission. They're going to work in the dark of night. Then they're going to come up and put something through to Congress that will be fast-tracked, like NAFTA. Yes or no vote, no amendments. And that's what they might get on. They actually might get this. President Obama indicated he might support it. This is very, very serious. So we just saw this baby boom cohort, older workers, retirees, just lost $17 trillion of wealth because of the incompetence of people like Larry Summers and Alan Greenspan, and now they want to take away their Social Security. Okay, so you should be very angry. We should all be very angry. And let's hope we can stop it. We stopped it in 2005. There's a lot more of us than there are of them. They have more money. But we know what we're doing, we're right, and we have the numbers on our side.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.